In 1972, here in Kerry, things were very different. 18 pence would buy you a pint of Guinness, 44 pence and you could rent a Pi television for a whole week. The Kerryman, 6 pence. And the latest must-have gadget was a transistor radio. Nationally, 1972 was the year of the Bloody Sunday attacks and the EU Common Market Yes vote. In America, Nixon was re-elected president, and on TV, MASH and The Waltons aired for the first time.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me.
Back at home, 23-year-old Alex Higgins won his first World Snooker title. Kerry beat Cork in the Munster final, but lost the All-Ireland final to Offaly in a replay. As Kerry plotted their comeback a few thousand miles to the west in Louisville, Kentucky, a man by the name of Muhammad Ali was doing likewise. Ali had famously lost his title the previous March in a bout dubbed the Fight of the Century. And this is where we begin our story about Muhammad Ali and his Kerry links. During the 60s, Cassius Clay surprised many by becoming heavyweight champion of the world. In 1964, he beat Liston by technical knockout when Liston refused to answer the bell for the seventh round. Within a week of this, Clay had joined the Nation of Islam and changed his name to Muhammad Ali.
Cassius Clay is a name no more, is that right?
Yes, sir. It's Muhammad Ali. Muhammad means worthy of all praises, and Ali means most high in the Asian African language.
How long have you had the name?
Well, for about 2 weeks now.
Was anybody special gave you the name?
Yes, sir. My leading teacher, the most honorable Elijah Muhammad.
A number of years later, he would controversially refuse to fight in the Vietnam War. For this, he was stripped of his title and his boxing license was revoked. Meanwhile, Killorglin native Michael Butty Shugru was hard at work building his own career. Butty, as the name would suggest, wasn't tall, but was powerfully built, with a strength and vigour you'd only get from working the peat bogs of Ireland. In his book, The Big Fight, Dave Hannigan writes of how Butty would often lift men heavier than him over his head and hold them there. In the days before television, this was great entertainment for everyone. Patrick Chubb O'Connor from Killorglin recalls one of Butty's more famous events.
He was in some particular circuses. He was kind of a strong man. He fought a famous fight in Langford Street in Killorglin with the famous Jack Dyle. At one stage, I think it only lasted a couple of rounds, and I think people said after that the real fight took place downtown somewhere when they were trying to divide the money.
Fast forward to 1972, and Butty Shugru announces to the Irish media that he is bringing Muhammad Ali to fight in Croke Park. But what made the announcement such a big deal? And why do the media have their doubts about Butty's big plans?
Muhammad Ali at this time was the biggest athlete on the planet, the most famous celebrity on the planet, I suppose. He was more famous than any movie star or anything. And Ireland at this point was a complete backwater in terms of international sport. And the thing is, Butty Shugru succeeded in bringing Muhammad Ali in his prime. This was not Muhammad Ali washed up in the late 70s. Some of Muhammad Ali's biggest fights lay ahead of him. And here he was coming to Ireland. You know, nobody... It was so ludicrous that journalists actually laughed in Butty Shugru's face. When he announced, I'm bringing Muhammad Ali to Ireland, the attitude was, yes, yeah, you are. Now go away back to London, you crazy Kerryman.
What the journalists didn't know was this so-called crazy Kerryman had it all sorted. But how?
Butty Shugru gained an audience with Hal Conrad, who was Muhammad Ali's kind of worldwide international promoter. And everywhere Hal Conrad ever went, he met people who said, would you bring Muhammad Ali to my country? I can organise it, I can promote it with you, etc. This happened to Conrad wherever he went. He's in London, Butty Shugru comes in to meet him, and Butty Shugru says, I want to bring Ali to Dublin. And Conrad's reaction is, yeah, well, when you show me the colour of your money, we can bring Ali to Dublin. And then this is where it gets unbelievably impressive. Butty Shugru goes to the Williams and Glynn Bank in London and gets the money underwritten. Butty went back to Conrad and said, here's the bank draft. Are we on to bring Ali to Dublin? And Conrad said, yes, Muhammad Ali will be in Dublin this July.
True to his word, Muhammad Ali stepped off a plane in Dublin Airport. And who should be the first person to greet him? Another Kerryman, Tim Chubb O'Connor, at the time a TDE for Kerry South.
Well, my father, of course, was in the Dáil at the time, and if there was anything needed through the government or anything at the time, he probably helped out. I think the main connection was that he was born in a place called Maynas. Well, he wasn't born there, but he lived his young days in a place called Maynas in Killardine. And Butty Shugrue came from the very same area. He was within maybe a couple of hundred yards. They lived together.
After entertaining the media in his own endearing way, he headed off to the Operman Hotel in Kiltearnan, his base for the next week.
I'm experienced now, professional. Jaw's been broke, been lost, knocked down a couple of times. Bad. Been chopping trees. I done something new for this fight. I done wrestled with an alligator. That's right. I have wrestled with an alligator. I done tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. That's bad. Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Bad dude.
Bad. Fast. Last night, I cut the light off my bedroom, hit the switch, was in the bed before the room was dark.
So how did he feel about the land of his ancestors?
Well, the first thing is he was shocked at the whiteness of the place. Ali arrived there, the first thing that struck him was the colour of the people. That night he went back to his hotel room and he phoned Conrad and he said, you know, where are all the black people in this country? Except he didn't use the phrase black people, he used the N-word. But there you go. Muhammad Ali was struck by, this is the whitest country I've ever been to. And if that was his first surprise, his second surprise was how much they loved him. They showered him with affection. Kids followed him like the Pied Piper when he walked down O'Connell Street chanting his name. I mean, it was a pure love affair and an instant love affair between Ali and the Irish people.
One of Ali's greatest strengths was his people's skills.
At one stage, he's out walking in Kiltearnan in the Dublin Mountains and an old woman comes out and invites him in. And as Muhammad Ali was wont to do, he goes in and sits down and has a cup of tea with her. At another stage in the visit, he's taken on an early morning tour of Dublin and he's outside Croke Park and a street sweeper comes along. So Muhammad Ali gets out of his car to have a chat with the street sweeper. And as I always like to think, imagine the street sweeper later trying to explain to people, no, I really did meet Muhammad Ali at 6 o'clock this morning just outside Croke Park.
He could mix it with the working class, but he was equally at home in the company of world leaders.
You know, this is the beauty of Ali. This is what separates him from the modern athlete and the modern celebrity. He goes into Dáil Éireann. Jack Lynch becomes the first Western head of state to invite him formally into government buildings. And not only does he go in and sit on the couch and chat with Jack Lynch for a while, he then does an entire tour of Dáil Éireann, culminating in him going to the Dáil canteen to eat his dinner in the canteen. I'm not sure whether that would be part of the modern athletic diet to eat in the Dáil canteen in the build-up to a big fight. But anyway, he sat there and he ate. And again, in another kind of a colourful incident, one of the staff in the canteen puts him on the phone to his wife back at home so she can talk to Ali, and he yucks it up with the wife on the phone for a few minutes. Again, just indicative of what a personable guy he was, kind of immersing himself in the entire country that he's visiting.
So what exactly did Jack Lynch and Ali talk about?
Apart from the fact that, you know, Ali says to him, I'm fighting in Croke Park when I'm there, and Jack Lynch says, yeah, I fought there myself a few times. And I think, you know, beyond that kind of, you know, good-natured stuff, they discussed Northern Ireland, and in one report from an eyewitness who was present during the discussion, they start discussing the situation in Northern Ireland, which at the time was incredibly bad and intense, and Ali asks Jack Lynch, would it have made much of a difference if John F. Kennedy had lived? If John F. Kennedy had lived, would he have made a greater impact on Northern Ireland, or would he have saved Northern Ireland from descending into the madness into which it had descended?
One of Ireland's greatest sportsmen, Kilkenny hurler Eddie Kerr, couldn't believe his luck when he got the opportunity to meet his hero.
Well, I was working in AIB in Capel Street in Dublin at the time, so 1972. And, of course, I was naturally thrilled because I was a huge fan of Ali from his Cassius Clay days. And I had already bought tickets for the fight anyway. So I was absolutely thrilled to be asked out, that I would have an opportunity to meet the great man. We shook hands and we talked a bit of small talk, and he asked me about hurling. He had seen, I think, some hurling on ABC World of Sport or something, and he was telling me he'd looked at a fierce, dangerous game, you know, and I thought this was quite funny. You know, someone that had gone into the ring with Sonny Liston, but he looked into my face and he said, you have no marks up either, you know, sort of stuff. I had brought two hurls and a couple of splitters, and I was to sort of give Muhammad Ali some lessons in hurling. So we went outside in front of the hotel, and I was showing Muhammad Ali how to do some of the basic, how to hold the hurl first of all, and he couldn't get to grips with that at all. He was you know, using his one hand like a tennis racket or whatever, you know. But I was showing him just how to rise the ball, the different ways of rising it, and he came over to me and whispered, now it's showtime, we put on a show. So he started attacking me then with the hurl and pulling down, and I was started defending myself, you know.
Not only did he get to meet Ali, he also came away with possibly the most unique sporting souvenir to be found anywhere in the world.
When we were finished then, just wrapping up, I got him to sign the hurl. And there was a lot of photographers there, of course, and I got a photo of the hurl being signed. And I was afraid that, you know, someone would take it out hurling and the whole thing would get lost or broken. But anyway, so I used to, I had it sort of stored in the attic in my house in Dublin. And then since that, I had, working in the bank, I had moved around a fair bit. I moved back to Kilkenny and to Carlow and Callan. And it transferred from the various attics and ended up here in Innistigue. But I met a number of journalists at a function in Dublin. I told them I had this hurl signed by Muhammad Ali, and they were absolutely flabbergasted that there should be such an item in the world. So I said it was in my attic at home, and they said I should, you know, get it framed and stuff like that. So anyway, shortly after, the Tanta Hurlers in Belfast rang me about a different matter. So, and I told him what I had. He was absolutely flabbergasted. And there was a courier van arrived the next morning at my house from Belfast to take this hurl to Belfast to be framed. So to make a long story short, it was framed in Belfast, and it's over my fireplace here with the photo of Muhammad Ali signing the hurl and the photo of the occasion of Muhammad Ali trying to play hurling.
The media hype was starting to kick in. RTE wanted in on the action. At the time, TV interviews with sports stars cost money. The BBC had paid £14,000 the previous year for the now famous interview between Parkinson and the champ. It's hard to believe what RTE paid for the interview. We let you know after the break. Okay, let's find out exactly what it did cost RTE.
I think it was like 150 quid or 200. All I know is, again, to continue with the theme of canteens, I know that Angelo Dundee, his manager, demanded cash for the interview. RTE didn't have the cash, and somebody was sent around to the canteen in Donnybrook to rustle up used readies to pay Muhammad Ali his fee. I'm sure it was 150 quid, which at that time, even at that time, was not a lot of money. Imagine today, you know, if you got Tiger Woods to sit down for an hour in a studio, how much you'd be paying. But this is all one-on-one Ali stuff. And I mean, I think in the history of Irish broadcasting, the Shannon versus Ali sit-down was one of the great, you know, one of the great landmarks in Irish broadcasting.
An interview between Cathal O'Shannon and Muhammad Ali aired the night before the big fight and enthralled the Irish audience.
People say I'm conceited, I talk too much, but they must have pity on me. It's hard to be humble when you're as great as I am.
And
won the Golden Gloves, the National AAU, and the Olympics. And then after the Olympics, I had all the gold medals, but no money. Well, you turned professional.
You told a story on one occasion about coming back from the Olympics with the medal to your own hometown. Did this make you a very big man in your own hometown? Did it completely change your life?
Well, you know, like, made me popular for a few days, but I wanted to do something good with it. So I went downtown. At the time, black people was marching to eat in the white restaurants, and they wanted rights to go where they wanted to. And so I said, I'll take this medal, and I'll go downtown, and I'll sit down in a restaurant. I got them on the spot now, and then I'll order something to eat. And I went down, and I had my medal on, and the lady was looking, and I said, I'd like a cheeseburger. She said, we don't serve Negroes. I said, I don't eat them either. Just give me a cheeseburger.
The dogs in the street knew that this fight was never going to be one of the classic fights of all time. Most people asked, who was Al Blue Lewis?
The thing about Al Blue Lewis is Al Blue Lewis was a convicted murderer who had kind of got this second chance in life. He got out because he'd helped a prison guard during a riot in Michigan. And he was a handy fighter, and he was too handy, if you like, because a lot of people were afraid to get in the ring with Al Blue Lewis because he was dangerous. And, you know, as you're padding your record and stuff, he isn't the kind of guy you want to the fight. At this point, Al Blue Lewis is pushing on, though, and Ali, he's handpicked by Ali's camp, really, because they think he'll give him a good fight without threatening him.
The day of the fight was looming, so Tralee man Christy Murray, along with a few others, headed for Croker.
There was a great buzz around the place. Guys were talking, would they go to Dublin to see this fight, and there was a great interest anyway, especially among the staff in the academy, the fella that used to follow the boxing, you know. There was Don Lomahony and Christy Lynch from the academy, and a friend of mine from that was involved in the athletics with me, that would be Sean O'Mahony, the late Sean O'Mahony. But we won tickets for the fight in a competition with the Evening Herald. We left after lunch on the day of the fight and arrived up and parked our car above Dublin and headed for Croke Park. When we arrived in Croke Park, we were positioned in the Hogan stand, and the ring was in the middle of Croke Park. So we were sitting down there for a while, and next thing, I decided myself, I said, I wasn't going to be sitting up here for the rest of the night. We're miles away from the ring. So I got up anyway, and the lads followed me, and we walked straight down onto the field, and we were behind the seats that were around the ring. No one stopped us.
Ticket sales had been slow for the fight, but he was hoping that gate receipts would make up the numbers on the night. Little did he know what other factors would come into play before the night was out.
The problem was, there was a couple of things went wrong for them. First of all, the day of the fight was the hottest day in Ireland for like many years. And obviously, as we do in Ireland, when the sun comes out, we try to take advantage. So they think that actually affected the gate, because more people were away taking advantage of the sun that should have been in Dublin, you know, should have been in the city of Dublin trying to get to the fight. I mean, just under 19,000 was the official attendance. And then there was another problem. They felt that Muhammad Ali had been so available in the week leading up to the fight that many people were happy. We've seen him. You know, we got to watch him train, we got to meet him on the street, that there wasn't a big deal about going to actually watch the fight as such. And then the other problem was, an age-old Irish problem, if you like, a lot of the dubs, and mostly it was dubs, knew that there was an easy way to get in free to the fight through the back of Hill 16. And this is what happens when the fight is beginning. The official attendance is 19,000, but when the fight is beginning, or just as the national anthems are being played, as one American describes it, it was like the scene in the Western where the Indians came over the hill, except there wasn't Indians, there was a load of Dublin scallywags coming down through Hill 16, having poured through there for nothing and getting in, you know, an estimated few thousand added onto the gate. The guards made an initial attempt to stop them, but they saw the size of the crowd coming in and said, you know, forget that, we let them off. So again, you know, there's a lot of reasons why it didn't work.
There was guys climbing the wall, and I don't know how they got over it, but anyway, they got over it anyway, and when they got into the ground, the late Sean O'Shea Conn, who was the secretary of the GA, was chasing around trying to catch him when he had no hope.
Botty needed a 30,000 strong crowd to break even. When it became obvious that there was nowhere near that number in Croke Park, the rumours began. Did Botty Shukru, the hard-working Kerryman, renege on his part of the deal? Again, Dave Hannigan explains.
Well, the thing is, like, a lot of the urban myths about this fight suggest, you know, that Botty ripped everybody off and Botty made off with money. When I wrote my book and I talked to a lot of people on all sides of this fight, and again, the story that came back to me was actually a much more honest portrayal of Botty, in that Botty took a hit himself on it, on the fight, but also after the fight was over, Botty was down in Sheriff Street in a house or in a flat that he was renting or that he was staying in for the week, and he had a big, huge bin bag full of money, plastic bin bag full of money that he used to pay. He paid off people, you know, people who had worked on the promotion, like guys who had done some promotion around the place and publicity in the papers and ads and stuff. He was paying them in used notes out of a bin bag full of money, and as one fella said, the money smelt of beer like it came straight from the pub in London and was being used to pay off his debts in Dublin. So, you know, he took a huge hit, I know that. I don't think, you know, this urban myth that he ripped people off, I think, is wrong. I think Conrad, you know, got paid. Al Blue Lewis got paid, who fought and lost to Ali, and Ali got paid. The big loser, I suppose, was the Williams and Glynn Bank, and again, the manager who signed off on the whole deal in the bank reportedly dropped dead of a heart attack soon after when he realised the hole that he'd been in.
For 1 week in July 1972, the greatest heavyweight boxer of all time graced us with his presence. What impact did Ali have on Ireland?
Well, I think his popularity here has been, you know, has endured. I think in the end of the Millennium polls, Ali was up there, despite the fact that a lot of people had never even seen him fight. He was still up there as one of the most popular athletes in Ireland, despite the years that had passed since his prime.
But more importantly, what impact did Ireland have on Ali?
I think the most interesting thing in terms of impact, I mean, if you follow the trajectory of Muhammad Ali's career, and in particular his political beliefs, when he arrives in Dublin in the summer of 1972, he's in a radical stage of his life where he's, you know, Nation of Islam, hardcore stuff, the white man is the devil kind of deal. And then when he leaves, I mean, Carl O'Shannon, in fairness, pulls him up on that kind of stuff in the famous interview. But when he leaves Ireland in 1972, having been, you know, showered with affection for 7 days by the whitest people in Europe, or the whitest country in Europe, he goes back, and you can definitely see a softening. Over the next year and a half, next couple of years, Ali, he's much less prone to use that white man is the devil, all whites are evil kind of rhetoric, because I think, and you know, it's not just a conspiracy theory, I think there's tangible evidence of this. How could he hate the white man so much when he went to a country where the white people there absolutely adored him and worshipped his every step and chanted his name and, you know, showed him nothing but love?
No sooner had Ali landed in Ireland than he was gone. But the love story between Muhammad Ali and the people of Ireland remains to this day, thanks in no small part to an enterprising Kerryman, Botty Shukru.
Catch me if you can.